Hey everyone, Kent Garrison here. I just wanted to let our Dallas area listeners know that we'll be doing a live podcast this Saturday at the Alamo Draft House in Richardson, Texas. We'll be giving you more details later this week, so just check the podcast feed about Wednesday night, and we'll give you all the details. But what we know now is we'll be doing a live podcast after a screening of MacGruber. So get excited. If you live in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, come on out, hang out with us, and we'll see you Saturday. Let's start the show. Ladies and gentlemen, oh, the burping. I'm Kent Garrison.
I'm Brian Gill.
And I'm Richard Barton.
And this is Mad
About
Movie.
Da, 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 da!
You sound insane. You realize that?
Yeah.
The whole world got crazy.
Seriously?
It's showtime.
Mad About Movies is your go-to podcast for all things cinema. Every week, we talk movie news, rumors, and rumblings, and break down a chosen movie of the week. But if you haven't seen it, don't worry, because we'll give you a spoiler alert. And stay tuned until the end for weekly recommends, which we suggest something you need to check out as soon as possible. And if you would like to keep the show going, you can do so by donating at our website, madaboutmoviespodcast.com. This week's movie of the week is what, Brian?
This week, we're going to be talking about HBO's The Jinx.
Brian was pushing really, really hard for Insurgent.
Yeah.
Basically blew up my phone.
Huge fan. Shailene Woodley's my favorite.
5 in the morning on a Saturday, he was calling me because he was actually camping out overnight at the Insurgent premiere, wondering if we were going to actually podcast it. No.
You guys coming? Huh?
Yeah,
I got your sleeping bags here.
Unfortunately, I was not going to see Divergent. You weren't going to make me research Divergent and then see Insurgent. So it just wasn't going to happen. I know we get some questions we have recently about how we pick our movies. And really, it's just what we feel up to at that point in time. And in my opinion, it's more of what deserves a conversation rather than what is the most popular movie at that given day.
Yeah, we kind of start with, here's the movie that's probably going to be the biggest at the box office. And if that seems like something we can converse about or that isn't going to make us want to kill ourselves or something like that, then that's usually the pick. If there's if it's, you know, something like Insurgent that I've seen Divergent, it's not very good. I've read the books. They're very mediocre. But you guys haven't seen either or haven't read or seen the movie.
No.
And there was no point in trying to catch you up. They're not good movies. Why are we going to have a conversation about that? The movies that we hate the most are the ones that are like C plus kind of movies, because there's just nothing to say. We either want to praise something or we want to really dig into why something is bad. And those movies that kind of sit just on the fringe of, they're not terrible, they're just kind of exist, those are the ones that we find hardest to talk about.
Yeah, and the last movie that we reviewed that starred Shailene Woodley and Miles Teller, one of our best episodes, in my opinion, The Spectacular Now. Richard loved that movie.
Don't forget The Cup. The Cup was a crucial member of that cast.
He got a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor.
He did have a Styrofoam cup. You're correct about that. That's all I remember from that movie, too.
Great performance out of that cup, too. Mm. Really, really. I believed it was a cup.
Which is not easy.
No. Rank your favorite cups all time in cinema. That's got to be on the list. It's like, you know, the thing from Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
A little
Holy
cup
Grail.
There.
Yeah.
Holy Grail. And Miles Teller's Styrofoam Alky cup.
I don't know. There's some pretty good coffee mugs out there, but I'll give you the benefit of the doubt here.
Yeah, about World's Best Boss on The Office? What do we do with that?
It's up there. It's up there. I got a late show cup that has something to say about that, Richard. We don't really have any movie news, fellas, for this week. Nothing really of interest that has to be talked about right this moment. But we do have a big, big thank you to give to some listeners. Richard, if you could pull up the list of contributors. I want to just say a huge thank you to the people who have continued to donate to the cause on our website and at madaboutmoviespodcast.com and donated cold hard cash to what we're doing here to keep the show going. Once again, we've said it before and we'll say it again right here. The show will always be free. We'll never charge subscriptions or anything like that for our normal podcast. You know, maybe we'll have premium content one day, which are podcasts that we've recorded that haven't been released, which are plentiful at this point. And, you know, maybe sometime for premium members, we'll release those to them. But our normal weekly podcast will always be free. But our goal really is to just have the show pay for itself. And, you know, that includes website fees, server fees, and, of course, movie tickets and screenings. So, you know, the people who have donated so far have been fantastic. And we've shouted most of you out already. But yet this week comes another week of people that deserve a shout-out who have donated in the most recent past. So, Richard, if you could prep those names right now, that would be awesome.
So, sure. Yeah. So, we've got some new, we didn't do this last week. So I think we have 2 weeks to catch up on, right, Kent?
Right.
Okay. So, so we'll start kind of in order from 2 weeks ago. So, a huge $50 donation from Adrian Sims.
Boom. Adrian,
$50. So, big shout to Adrian, for it. We are most grateful to you. We'll get you all set up. You are actually the one that recommended, I believe, this week's episode. No, it wasn't you. So, you know what? Screw you. but Adrian, thank you so much for your donation. Then we have a donation of $25 from Tim Fisher's hot sister.
Hey, Tim. Still don't have any picks, by the way.
No picks right yet. No picks of Tim Fisher's. Hopefully it's Amy Fisher. Yeah, Long Island Alita jokes. Haven't heard one of those in a long time.
None of our audience knows who that is. None. I'm surprised you guys know.
Come on, man. Who doesn't know? And then we have a $15 donation from Tim Ehrens. So, Tim, big shout. Thank you for the $15.
Tim A.
So, we got that. We have a $10 donation from Melissa D'Amico. $10. Thank you. $25 donation, and I'm probably going to mess up this last name. Christoph Shurek.
Oh, yeah.
Shurek. Yeah. He's a big emailer of the show and a good friend. Always has interesting things to send our way. I think he is the one that recommended the episode this week. Maybe not. So if it's not you, you know what? Screw you, too. But and then we get to the big kahuna here, guys. And we know that we talked about this and we didn't think anyone would go through with this, but someone has, and we're so excited. A big donation, our biggest yet, from Eric Bishop. So we are very eternally grateful to you, Eric. $250 donation.
Woo, baby.
$250.
That's freaking believable.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Really great. And so he gets a few things. He gets, obviously, the shout out, which is worth more than gold. He gets to come on and do an episode. So, Eric, we emailed you. If you haven't checked your email, we'd love to hear what episode you would like to come on and review one of your favorite movies. That can be something that is out there or something that is forthcoming. Just let us know, and we'll get that set up. You can come on and Skype in and talk about one of your favorite movies or most anticipated movies, and we'll make fun of you ruthlessly. So that sounds fair. Great, for $250. Yeah. No, we would love to talk to you about a movie and look forward. Obviously, since you've given us money, you're clearly brilliant. And then you get a signed game used microphone that the three of us will sign at the MacGruber screening and send out to you. So that's worth, I mean, at least as much as the microphone is worth.
Actually, it's the microphone that started it all. So a lot of history, a lot of episodes recorded with the microphone. Yeah. It's a really cool display piece, I'm not going to lie. Richard actually has it on his shelf as a display piece as we speak. Really cool microphone. We'll sign that for you. And I'm going to throw together a goodie box for you, Eric. It's going to include copies of such great Mad About Movies classics, such as Now You See Me,
MacGruber, Draft Day,
and maybe another. You know, we're gonna send a little care package to you, and you
a $250 care package. We're not very good at There's a reason we're not.
We don't have a financial advisor, so
so we're gonna send you $275 worth of material. So we're down
and to PS4, $30 for shipping.
Send you a PS4. It's a write-off.
No, but we would love to send you a little something, because that is too generous, and we feel silly accepting that. But we do have a new announcement. Kent and I were talking this over. This is even new to Brian. What did we give away for $100?
You get to come on and review a movie. Right.
It's for $250. You get another game used microphone. You guys still have an extra microphone, right? We're limited on these. Okay. Yeah. Game used microphone.
I already signed it to Smithsonian, though. So
we'll get it back. A goodie basket from us. And you get to come on and review a movie. And for $500, Brian, you're going to like this. You get to come on and review a movie.
Already
get a game used autographed microphone. And you, yourself, with your picture, gets to be an American treasure.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Shocking.
Or anyone you choose. If you want to gift it, like you want your mom to be an American treasure, $500 to us. And there might be, and we have means to do this, there might be a denim vest in it for you.
Yeah.
Monogrammed and everything.
Yes. 100%. The $500 donation gets an American treasure and one of our signature American treasure denim vests, which we mail to all American treasure inductees.
So
we've yet to receive.
It might be Bill Cosby's, though. Just that one.
He still hasn't sent it back.
Brian Williams. But the cool thing is that it was used in combat. So extra little piece there.
We don't want to know where Bill Cosby's has been. So just keep it. I'm still personally floored by Eric's donation. Mind blowing.
Seriously.
You're forever in the Mad About Movies Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And we'll get a little Hall of Fame going of donatees. On the
wherever we
eventually
go from here, Eric, you were the patron saint of our podcast here. Like, that was an amazing thing. I'm still kind of concerned that he's going to email us back and be like, I thought I was donating money to the SBCA or to end apartheid or something like that.
Still haven't confirmed whether he intended on donating $25 or $250. Might have accidentally hit an extra zero there. So if it's 25,
now we've guilted him into it. We've got to keep it. Sorry.
If it's 25, hit us up and we'll get get your money right back.
Minus some service charges.
Right, exactly.
No, but thank you, everyone.
Yeah, thank you. Huge thank you to the people who donated and the people who have left reviews. I noticed we've gotten a ton of iTunes reviews in the past week. We'll shout those out at a later date, but keep those coming. You've done a fantastic job, listeners, chiming in and giving us your support. So thank you. And we'll see you this Saturday at the Alamo Draft House, and we'll celebrate. How about that?
Hey, one more thing on this.
Okay.
Because it's been a while. On our top 10 movies of all time episode, we told people to send us their top 10 movies of all time, listeners. And we get those still periodically when people go back and listen to that episode, but we love reading those and like engaging with you on those. So always feel free to email us your top 10 films of all time at madaboutmoviespodcast@gmail.com. We love hearing about those.
Exactly. Yeah, we need to do a listener focused top 10 movies episode sometime and just discuss the movies that people have submitted. That would be a great idea for a throwback week.
It would.
We'll have to work that in. But no movie news, rumors, rumblings this week, guys. Like I said, not much. I can't wait until next week's podcast or the week after the MacGruberthon. But
it's like Normathon, 24 hours.
Exactly. But without further ado, guys, let's discuss the Jinx. We'll start off just by giving general thoughts on this series, and I might have to go ahead and say spoiler alert fairly early in this episode. We'll save it for after general thoughts, but immediately after general thoughts, we're probably going to go into more spoilery stuff. But please check out The Jinx on HBO, HBO Go. I know most of you have friends that have HBO that'll let you borrow a user login or something like that just so you can watch this series. And, you know, I don't condone this at all, but I will fully support pirating this series and listening to our podcast on it because
high praise.
I mean, it's seriously worth going to prison for the rest of your life. And I can honestly say that. But
You know what? Now we know you'll have a cellmate.
God, I said we were saving spoilers, Richard. No, but seriously, this is going to be one that's hard to talk about without spoilers. So, again, early spoiler warning right now for The Jinx. I will just say, man, I was pretty into the Serial podcast this past summer, and I honestly thought that as far as serialized telling a crime story, that was going to be about as good as we got for the foreseeable future. But man, did the Jinx just one up it?
Seriously.
like no tomorrow.
Should we give kind of a synopsis of beyond general thoughts? Just this is a little bit different from our average movie of the week. Should we just kind of, because I know there's a lot of people that really may not even know what we're talking about.
Yeah, good idea. So the Jinx is basically a documentary, serialized documentary series on HBO. It's 6 episodes long, and it really tells the story of Robert Durst. And Robert Durst came from a wealthy family in New York.
His parents and family
are huge real estate developers and investors in New York. It's said throughout the series that they're in the top 5 wealthiest real estate developers in Manhattan. And when you think about it and think about the number of buildings in Manhattan, it's quite staggering that he would be in the top 5. So let's just say money has never been a problem for Robert Durst and his family. And so basically he's gotten mixed up in a lot of bad stuff throughout his life. Didn't come from the absolute best family situation, I guess you could say. And we'll go into more details about that. But gotten mixed up with a few murders. Has been a suspect in 3 separate murder incidents throughout his life. And basically, the Jinx is Robert Durst's attempt to come clean, or not about the murders, but to clear
his name.
To clear his name. Andrew Jarecki is the director, and All Things, what is it, All Good Things?
Yeah.
He directed All Good Things back a few years ago, and Robert Durst.
Have you seen that?
I have not. No,
I have actually. So it'll be interesting to discuss later.
Yeah,
I just wanted to ask.
Haven't gotten a chance yet. But it turns out Robert Durst actually got in touch with Andrew Jarecki and his crew and wanted this to happen, this series to happen. He wanted his story to be told under his perspective, and like we said, to clear his own name. And without getting into spoilers, it doesn't really go according to his plan, I don't think, when it's all said and done. Not to say the people that are listening to this haven't heard the news over the past week. It's been just about everywhere what Robert Durst's current situation is. But so that's sort of the synopsis, is tells the story of his life, his family life, these 3 separate incidents, and you know, whether he is guilty or not guilty in each of these 3 separate incidents. And once again, it's 6 episodes. Each episode is less than an hour long. One of them's only like 38 minutes long or something like that. So easily bingeable in a weekend or a couple days if you're into it. But once again, like I said, it's worth your time.
Yeah.
So I want to give my general thoughts, and they are, man, I was just completely enthralled in this. I love true crime stories. You know, I kept up to date with like things like 2020 and Dateline. Whenever they do these true crime stories on Friday and Saturday nights, I really, really enjoy them. But this just took it to a whole nother level. Mainly production value wise, I was just completely floored with the reenactments and the cinematography and special effects and music, and pretty much every aspect of this was far superior to any other true crime story, you know, investigation discovery story, the first 48 or something that you would see on any average cable channel. It really takes it to another level. And the fact that they're kind of filming this as it goes, they don't really know how it's going to end while they're filming it, is also very interesting. So you really get a sense that this is unfolding before their very eyes. And I personally didn't know about Robert Durst before this show. I wasn't familiar with his story. You know, apparently it was a very big story in the early 2000s. You know, they spoofed it on Saturday Night Live and everything, The Daily Show. And so if it goes that far, it's probably a pretty big interest story from a nationwide perspective. But wasn't very familiar with it, but man, was I interested in this show and finding out this guy's story. So those are my general thoughts. You know, it's hard to talk about once again without going into spoilers, but man, love the Jinx, and the way it ends is just fantastic. And of course, we'll go into plenty of those details. So Brian, what are your general thoughts on the Jinx?
I'm with you, Ken. I love this kind of thing. Serial was just such a cool – it was such a cultural phenomenon, and it was really, really enjoyable. And I came to it late, so I got to listen to almost the entire thing before it ended, which was really good too, because I think it would have killed me a little bit waiting week to week. And so that was kind of tough. But you're right. Like this just blows Serial out of the water. And Serial is doing a different thing, so it's not really quite – it's not an, I'll say this, it's not an affront to Serial to say that The Jinx is just such a, so much better. But this is, it's so enthralling. And I was locked in after about 10 minutes of the first episode. Yeah. And that's like the worst 10 minutes of the whole thing, you know?
Right.
It gets so much better as it goes. And the last three episodes are some of the more gripping television I've ever watched. Like there are many, many movies and TV shows out there that are dramas, that are thrillers, that are whatever, that are trying to accomplish what The Jinx accomplished in a documentary. And that's just such a rare feat, I think. So I was just totally mesmerized. I watched the whole thing twice, actually.
Same, yeah.
Because I thought we kind of talked about we might record earlier in the week. And so I blew through it, and then my wife was out of town for a couple of days, and she came back and she wanted to watch it too. So we our Saturday night was just watching The Jinx over, and it was, I'll say this, watching it twice, I caught more the second time around. I just got to watch him because I already knew what was going to happen, obviously, and it was kind of haunting. Like I'm not somebody who watches too, there's not much out there that scares me or keeps me up at night or something like that. I was unsettled the second time around, more so than the first. And I had a little bit of issue going back to sleep because it was just such a creepy thing. And obviously we'll get into specifics on that, but I would encourage you, if you have not seen The Jinx, find a way. Most cable providers, if you call them and complain about your bill, they'll give you 3 months of free HBO. So try, do something, get HBO.
Good call. Good call.
It takes, each episode is like 40 to 45 minutes long. It's such a quick viewing, and do yourself a favor as well. And don't look up anything about this show. Don't Google the names. Don't look in the backstory, any of that stuff. Just, if you haven't seen it,
turn this off
and go just figure out a way to get a hold of it and watch it, because it's I don't know that you're gonna get another thing like this. Like, this is such a unique experience, I think.
Yeah, Richard.
Yeah, so I just finished it about an hour or two ago.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was, I'm fresh to it, so I'm still in the creep out mode. I knew the story. I'd seen the Gosling movie and I'd seen some buzz around it for a couple years, but you know, kind of like the DuPont thing with Foxcatcher, you know, knew of it, but had never really done like a Wikipedia deep dive or anything. I don't even think I've seen all of the Gosling movie. I think I came across it and, you know, watched 40 minutes of it or something. So that's kind of my history with the case, or cases, I should say. I am not a big true crime guy. I like Serial a lot. I like Serial mostly because I like radio, and I like to, mm-hmm. I liked that it sort of brought back the theater of the mind or whatever. And so I didn't really care about the true crime of it. This does compare favorably to Serial in that, you know, we won't say what it is, but this has resolution, where Serial, you know, double spoiler here, in fact, doesn't. That's a, you know, even though it's an unsettling conclusion and not completely finalized, it's still something, right? And so that's something that's really has something. This really has that going for it. You're right, Kent. The dramatizations are pretty. They're the best I've ever seen, I think. I can't think of anything that had better dramatization, except for, you know, obviously every Lifetime.
You know, Rescue 911. Rescue 911.
Yeah, you're right. So that was all fantastic. Production values, great. And the fact that I enjoyed this as much as I did, where I've seen a ton of 2020 things with people that are into that, you know, in my life throughout, you know, whether it's moms or girlfriends or whatever, I'll sit through one. But it's like,
not, I've never really enjoyed it, but this I really kind of did, I think, and I think it's because of how well the narrative is told. And I wasn't really, you know, glancing at my watch constantly or anything like that. So it almost seems too good to be true in terms of the convenience of some things, but I don't think it is. I think it's just one of those really lucky, kind of beautiful strokes of artistic luck.
It really raises so many questions, and that's really what I like most about it, is that it has sparred such a wide array of conversation in all aspects of what we do, whether it's podcasting or TV or, you know, blogging or whatever. Everyone seems to be chiming in on the Jinx. And, you know, for an HBO show, we've seen True Detective in the past year, or Game of Thrones, or maybe even Girls at one point, that have had their day. But the fact that this is based on reality, and that America and the world is seeing these events still unfold before our very eyes, is quite jarring, and it's incredible to experience. I will say that firsthand. And I guess we can go into specifics of these episodes. I've got it. I, like you, Brian, I watched it twice. The first time I just kind of sat back and kind of let it hit me. And the second time I watched it more closely. I took notes on it, things that stuck out to me as things that if I was the law enforcement, the authorities, that I would be looking into from day one, things that obviously spell guilt or non-guilt. And so I want to go over some of these things. I don't know if you've kept a logbook like I have on this, but I want to sort of start.
Detective Kent.
It's
on the case.
It's not as nearly as detailed as you would imagine from me, as you would expect from a Kent Garrison production. I want to go through this episode by episode and start really from the beginning of this story. And episode one is called Body in the Bay. And I don't know if this is what sparred Jarecki's immediate interest in the story. I understand he was first interested in the disappearance of Robert Durst's wife, Catherine Durst, back in 1982. And the disappearance of this man, Morris Black, whose body was found in the bay in the 2000s, or in 2001, I believe.
Yeah.
Is just, I guess, the most recent relative event in Robert Durst's life. So we start off with a body being found in Galveston Bay. This body was dismembered, chopped into several different pieces, and found by a young fisherman boy, you know, a young kid out fishing one weekend, and stumbled upon all of these body parts in separate bags, mind you, all at once.
So, and, Timmy, how was your fishing trip?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I found a dead body. It's not uncommon here in Dallas either, we should say. This is a common occurrence if you live in Texas.
Yeah, Trinity.
Exactly.
It's called Trinity fishing right there. That's good times.
So he dumps this body in the bay of Morris Black, and the identity is found through fingerprints. But part of what is found in one of the bags, I guess he wrapped the body in newspaper, was the address 2213 Avenue K, which was a newspaper address to Robert Durst's house. And, you know, first inclination, first thought is, how can you be that stupid unless you're trying to get caught? Is that what you thought? I just thought that was, I mean, how could you, first of all, put a chop up a body, put it in garbage bags, not weight the garbage bags at all, like put cement blocks in them or anything, and just chunk them in a river, but have a piece of paper in the bag with your address on it?
Yeah, he thought it was going to sink, and when it didn't, he did not... he did not game plan appropriately. Yeah. I mean, he did the one thing. Are we in spoiler territory at this point?
We are now in spoilers. Yes, spoilers.
So he removed, when the bags wouldn't sink, he removed the head. He was smart enough to realize that A, it would be more easily identifiable if you can, this is so grisly, but if you can see the head. But moreover, and I think this plays a bigger part later, without the head, the prosecutors could not say definitively how he had been murdered. Like, because of the self-defense claim that he's able to make, because they can't say, you know, he got shot in the back of the head, you executed him or whatever. That was a big part of why he was able to get off. And I'll say this, kid, like, there's so many times where Durst is really smart, and then he does something stupid, like leave a magazine with his address in it, in the bag, with a cut-up body. Like, it's such a weird – and there's so many weird things about this dude and this whole case, but that's one of the things that really stuck out to me. Is like, how can you be this smart but this stupid at the same time?
I want to actually ask you before we go on – maybe this is other episodes, but what did you find smart about Mr. Durst? I didn't find much smart about him other than the fact that he's handled his money well, I guess, or seems to have an unlimited supply of money, or the fact that he's been able to convince so many people of his innocence for so long.
Yeah, well, that's part of it.
He's deceptive, very deceptive, I believe.
He's very deceptive, and he's very good at that. And I don't know if that necessarily makes him smart or not, but it's definitely a skill, and he's very, very good at it. And that goes down to things like, again, like removing the head from the bags. That's honestly a really smart move, because it made it much – that may have ended up being the thing that got him off on that trial, because the prosecution cannot say, dude, you murdered him. That was really smart. The stuff with his wife – just off the cuff telling her, yeah, I called her, I talked to her, and yeah, I went next door and I had a drink. Like, all these little things that – there's a lot of it that's bad, bad, bad police work. But he also was smart enough to know that he was not a suspect at that point, and anything he could do to ease them into a – in another direction was going to work in his favor, and it did perfectly. I mean, he was never even really looked at for the murder of his wife, even though that's, you know, any detective will tell you that's the first person you look at in the event of a murder or a disappearance or something. You look at the spouse, and that never seemed to even be a part of the investigation. And I think a part of it was he threw them off the scent so quickly that they never really questioned what his motives might have been. Now, again, that's terrible police work, but he got off on that by kind of outsmarting or at least quick thinking, I guess.
Yeah, another aspect of what it was revealed in episode one, the fact that he had gone by these multiple identities, Dorothy Siner, Emilio Vigioni, Diane Wynn, Jim Tross, Maury Block, kind of very similar to a Morris Black, you know, obviously hiding from something. And he says later in the series that I just didn't want to be Robert Durst anymore. Mm-hmm. I just don't buy that on so many levels. The fact that he just didn't want to be Robert Durst. He didn't want to be associated with the Durst family because,
or Limp Bizkit
or Fred Durst.
And he did go on the run in about 2000. So
that's what I was going to get to that. I think it all pieces together. You heard Nookie was like, I'm going on the lam.
Chocolate Starfish just really pushed him over the top.
Just keep rolling, 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 baby. But, I mean, he's obviously has something to hide here. And once again, he was dressing as a woman and going by all these alternate egos before the murder of Morris Black. And so it says something to me about his guilt in previous altercations or in previous cases, the fact that he's willing to drop everything and move into a small apartment in Galveston, Texas. Yeah. So that's suspicious to me. It ends up the Morris Black murder happens. He is wanted for murder due to the his address being found in the bags that Morris Black's body was found in, and ends up being arrested for shoplifting a hoagie while he had who hasn't? While he had $5,000 in his pocket and $37,000 in cash in his car at the time. So once again, Brian, I emphasize how stupid can you be, honestly?
Yeah. I think he wanted to get caught at that point. I really do. I think he was tired of being on the run.
Not to summarize this entire podcast, but I just think he loves being arrested and the whole process of having to explain himself out of stuff and prove he's innocent. I just think there's some deep satisfaction in his soul that really, really likes being like murdering somebody or committing crimes and then being able to explain himself out of it and go out about his life. Like there's some sick, twisted part of his personality that I don't understand.
I totally agree.
It's quite quite disturbing. Episode 2 is called Poor Little Rich Boy, and this goes more into depth about his past, his family life. His mom committed suicide when he was very young, so that led to a little bit of his depression, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I think that I would, if I was a psychologist, I would have some theories about how where that put him from at a mental standpoint for the rest of his existence.
We get more info about his wife, Kathy Durst, and how Kathy Durst was from a average American family, and how when Robert Durst associated with Kathy Durst, he was always associating with an average American family, which in my opinion, he didn't feel like he wanted to be a part of one. He makes it very clear that he doesn't want to have kids with Kathy. And, you know, I think it's explained loosely, but that she became pregnant and he didn't want her to be pregnant, but she wasn't going to refuse the pregnancy. And, you know, all of a sudden she disappears forever. And a note is found in, I guess, in his residence that has a list of things such as a dump, a boat, a bridge, a shovel, dig, tow, and things such as that. And an authority figure or a police officer comes on screen during this episode and says, well, it was winter, so wasn't going to be able to dig a hole. Like, completely dismisses the entire list because of the fact that there was frost on the ground and that it's hard to dig a hole with frost. Like Robert Durst was thinking that or something, you know, like when you murder somebody, I mean, I've done it a few times. When you murder somebody, digging a hole is one of the first things you'll think of.
Brian, did you hear that? Did he just confess accidentally? Yeah,
it's okay.
We got him. Flugelhorn. Now the cops busted.
I'm on parole. It's all good. Don't worry about me.
His former bandmates, all of them.
And, you know, it's just very suspicious that that list was found and they completely wrote him off there. Don't understand that at all. How you cannot think of him as a suspect after that. And the fact that he was married to her, but she just disappeared. And he goes on in that episode or the episode later and he's asked, is she dead? And Durst says, it's possible that she's alive. Not likely. I think that she's most definitely dead, but I don't know that for sure. Like if your wife disappears, you're going to have your last breath say that she's still alive. I would think if you truly were in love with her and she truly disappeared, not on your terms. Do you know what I'm saying? Like there are people that have missing children for 20 years that still tell themselves, nope, he's alive somewhere. Oh, we'll find him someday. But the fact that he just completely dismisses her existence at all is troubling as well. So what did you think about the, I guess, Kathy Durst disappearance? Do you think that Robert Durst killed Kathy Durst? Richard?
Yes.
Any reason?
Because I think he's killed other people and he was pretty closely tied. And I think you're absolutely right with the motive of the of her getting pregnant.
Yep.
No, I think that's open and shut case. This is why I'd be a terrible, you know, like person in criminal justice, because I'm either, you know, I make my guilty and innocent decisions in the matter of milliseconds.
Right. And, you know, the police wrote it off in this episode by saying that there's no corpse, no crime scene. This is a missing persons case. And I just don't buy that, because you can murder somebody in the wilderness or in the woods or somewhere that's not like at your house where a crime scene can be roped off and evidenced by police, you know. There are ways to get around, I guess, leaving a bunch of evidence behind. And obviously, Durst showed lack of ability with that, with the Morris Black murder. But I just think that maybe it was a murder that was so clever, and, you know, I'm giving him credit here, that honestly, he just got away with it. And that's sad to think, you know, that people can just get away with murder. But he's proven multiple times in this series that it can be done, and you can go to court and go through the justice system, judicial system, and still get away with murder.
Yeah. Especially at the time, 1982.
Right.
When he walks into the police department and says, "Look, it has not been a happy marriage for quite a while." I think it's part of the times of, well, this woman probably just ran away from her abusive husband, and that's where we stop. And
right.
Oh, he told us that he called her and she checked in and the doorman saw her, and later he was having a drink with the friend. Okay. Well, I'll take his word for it. You know, it's not good police work at all.
Right. We move on to episode 3, The Gangster's Daughter. And this is, details the Susan Berman murder.
Wow.
And this is crazy. Yeah.
I think this is where that episode is where things really start to take off. Like, you really start to see some of the psychosis of this dude, and it just, that story just goes to a whole nother level when they bring this stuff into it.
So the official story behind it is Jeanine Pirro is a district attorney in New York, and she decides it upon herself that she's going to reopen the case against Robert Durst and the disappearance of Kathy Durst, because pretty much everyone in New York, anyone that knew Robert Durst or knew the situation, thought and knew that that Robert Durst murdered his wife.
Yeah.
But there was no trial. There was it was basically just, well, she's gone, she's a missing person, hope we find her someday, end of story. Apparently, Susan Berman knew the story, and so Robert Durst eliminated her.
Yeah.
Because she knew that he had murdered her, so not very smart to eliminate the only other person that knows your close friend. And, you know, if you're wanted for murder or people think you've murdered somebody, probably not a good idea to murder somebody else. And she's not
or
gonna,
is it?
Or is it? Yeah. I mean, it's worked out so far. I'll say that. Yeah. Evidence against this was a note left for police that was addressed to the Beverly Hills Police, with Beverly spelled incorrectly in block letters, and inside the letter wrote 1527 Benedict Canyon and the word cadaver. We can talk
creepy,
about this now, but creepy even to talk about. But the police wrote it off by saying, "Well, obviously this is somebody that's in the medical profession, because nobody knows the word cadaver except for people in the medical profession." Wouldn't you think that somebody who's murdered somebody and didn't want to be found out would use terminology that they wouldn't normally use? In your opinion, doesn't that seem like, if you were to step into the shoes of somebody who had wrote a ransom note, you would try and disguise your language at least a bit?
Yeah, maybe so. And to give the officers credit there, as opposed to the New York detectives, that they quickly identified that this is somebody who is close to the victim. That was an immediate, okay, that somebody close to this person killed her. And whether it's the medical thing, I think maybe possibly threw them off a little bit. But I think those guys did a really good job of trying to make their case. I think they suspected – I think you could gather that from the interviews with the detectives and whatnot. But that they were pretty – that beyond the mob connection – I think there was a lot of speculation that Durst was the guy who killed her, but they just couldn't make the case fit together, which is kind of sucks for everybody involved.
Yeah, and it's sad to think that they didn't look into all the evidence that they had at their disposal, and we'll talk about that towards the end of these episodes. But we move on to the state of Texas versus Robert Durst. And this is
Texas.
This is when we actually get the trial of the Morris Black case.
Yeah.
And this was the most fascinating episode, in my opinion. Just a lot of the raw footage of the case was used, of the courtroom trial. And just in a fascinating watch on all levels. The defense attorney really tried to push Robert Durst as a good guy. And he says things like, "Bob has feelings. He had these pictures of him and his wife in his wallet when he was arrested." And, you know, nobody who's ever murdered somebody has had pictures in their wallet. I mean, that's basically what he was saying. I just don't understand how that made a case for that.
I think the best thing, the smartest thing that Durst ever did was hiring that defense team, because I thought they did an amazing job. Like, they threw off the prosecution so hard by calling him first to the stand. I think that was a shocking move, a shocking revelation. If I'm ever accused of murder, probably one of you two. Well, let's be honest. But if I'm ever accused of murder, I want to hire those guys. Like, I thought they did an amazing job of humanizing him just enough without going over the top on that, and just bringing a strategy to the table that the prosecution could not match. Now, the flip side of that is, I don't think the prosecution did a good job at all. I think they thought they had an open and shut case, and they went in. Just a sports analogy, that reeked of a one seed taking on a 16 seed and then just getting shocked by an upset like that. Because I don't think they did not come off to me in either the current interviews or in the courtroom footage like they knew what they were doing.
We went into gruesome details of the murder of Morris Black and the dismemberment of Morris Black and the disassembling of the body of Morris Black. I just couldn't fathom why you would dismember and chop somebody up that you didn't kill purposefully. That's where I couldn't get my head around the jury's decision towards the end. Somebody accidentally shoots themselves. Would you not just call the cops and be like, hey man, this guy accidentally shot himself? Why would you take it upon yourself to cut him up and hide the body if you weren't guilty of the crime at hand? Did you feel that way?
I feel that way, but I thought that the defense did a fantastic job of making the district attorney in New York, Janine Pirro, I think.
Yeah.
They did a fantastic job of making her out to be a villain that was pursuing him for something he had not done and had never even been charged with, and made him out to be a victim. And let's be honest, like, we're from Texas. We know that not everybody in Texas is a big hick, but there's plenty of down-home folk, especially if you're in the Galveston area, that I think I would be – I feel like you could push them to not trust the big mouth Yankee, you know, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
And to make them – I mean, they did a great job of making Durst out to be the victim on that. And, you know, he's just – look, guys, he's just terrified that this angry Yankee is going to take his freedom, because that's her main goal in life, is to pursue him and take him down. And, I'm not saying I would vote that way. I don't think I would have. But I've also – have either of you guys ever been on a jury – because it's the worst.
No, I almost got picked for one, but I actually had a flight booked for the next day, so I got out of it. But
gosh, I have been, and it was just a traffic, a three-car pileup sort of thing, and it was the worst. It was the worst 2 days of my life, because everyone in the room is an idiot, to be honest. Like, it was, you have a system where there are at least half the jury is going to be people who never in their daily lives have a platform to talk, and they get in a room and they have this power, and suddenly they start talking, and the case that I was on was the most just open and shut. There's no one at fault here. This woman is crazy. This older woman that I was, that was the plaintiff, fired her attorney during the trial and represented herself. She's like a 70-year-old woman who barely speaks English. And to give you an example, like, she could not understand. There was a paralegal who was up on the stand at one point, just reading an affidavit from one of the police officers that was on the scene of this accident. And she could not understand that was not the police officer, and that she could not ask questions that were not directly written out in the affidavit. Like the yeah. judge had to stop her over and over and over again. It was such an open and shut case. And we deliberated for 6 hours. It was the most – I was just banging my head against the wall. It was the worst experience ever. And that's what you get when you go to a jury of your peers. You get this weird collection of people, many of whom really don't have anything better to do today. And
it's the same people that are like focus groups for TV shows.
Yes, totally. Yeah.
That's unbelievable. And
you know, crafted a society in which we give all these people the power.
Yes.
Great job, us.
Yeah. And, you know, this, like I said, this TV series brings about so many questions. Yep. And one of the main questions is, are we even doing this right? Like, I mean, honestly, what the heck are we even doing where if this can white, happen?
You have to really try to get convicted. Like, you have to, if you're like white and affluent, I mean, it's almost like a game. I feel like this guy, like, he tried so hard to get convicted or caught, and they're like, no, I mean, he's a rich white guy. He's good. Obviously, he's clear.
He had pictures in his wallet when he was arrested, guys. What do you want? I mean, it just – you literally commit murder and you don't get convicted. I mean, it's just – it's unbelievable to think that happened. I mean, just the look on his face when they pronounce him not guilty in that episode of the murder of Morris Black, his face just screams guilt. And, you know, it's said in the episode that never more than three jurors found him guilty at any point during the trial. And I just don't know how that's possible, considering he dismembered the body and went into hiding and all this crap. Like, literally no evidence suggested that he was telling the truth whatsoever, other than the fact that they heard him talk, and a lady said, you know, when he was up there on this witness stand, I thought he was speaking from the heart. Like, just completely ignored all the evidence against him and just said he seemed like a really good guy, so there's no way he could murder
somebody.
That's
partly on the prosecution because they did not bring any charges beyond – we saw one episode of footage, so who knows all the – I mean, I haven't dug in and researched every single thing that happened, but it didn't seem like they brought any other charges to the table. And that – I mean, I think the guy's name's Chip Lewis, is the younger defense attorney. When he did the closing arguments and said, look, the only charge here is murder. So we have proven, to their minds at least, we've proven he didn't murder anybody, that it was an accident, that he was fighting for his life, that this person was in his house, which, you know, in Texas, even Durst said, like, you can pretty much do whatever you want if somebody's in your house and they're not supposed to be. I just think it was a bang up job by the defense and just a really lazy, uninspired effort by the prosecution.
Yeah, and the fact that, you know, he said he shot at the eviction notice, but there's no bullet hole.
Yeah.
I mean, almost everything that he argued was proven not true by the prosecutor, and still not guilty. And there was no head, you know? Like, the fact that the head – he got rid of the head is the most obvious part of this whole thing. Like, why would you have gotten rid of the head if you didn't shoot him in the head on purpose, you know? Like, show us the head, and then we can move on, you know, if he – in fact, if it was an accident. But just incredible that he was found not guilty, and just made me question a lot of things. But we move on. We digress to later in the series another episode called Family Values. This episode – goes more into Moreland Biscuit reference. Yeah,
exactly.
Jeez.
Sorry.
Best tour ever. Corn and Limp Biscuit. Kid Rock. Our millennials remember.
Gosh.
That is pretty weird. Yeah. That is last day. Yeah, that's a little. Yeah.
Turns out Andrew Jarecki is just a huge Limp Biscuit fan.
Who is it?
Yeah, exactly.
Who is it? Remember when Fred Durst wanted to be a movie director? We haven't done any of his films yet on the show, but we will.
He's still working his way up. He's in the independent. If you're in independent cinema, you know Fred Durst has made some great films.
Yeah, with his backwards red Yankees hat and his little lens scope around his neck.
The Family Values episode goes more into the family aspect of his life, the fact that his brother resented him, the fact that his brother thought he was going to kill him at one point, and how his brother didn't want anything to do with Robert Durst. And it talks about when Robert Durst was in prison for a short time, and he made friends with the prison inmates, and he says about them, "They accomplish stuff on their own. No matter what I'll do, it'll be because I have money." And that says a lot to me, the fact that he just really hated being rich. Like he said, no matter, he can make his own business, do whatever, but people will always say, well, he was wealthy when he was younger. He's a millionaire, so it wasn't hard for him. You know, he really just couldn't distance himself from his own family. And I think somebody says at one point in the episode, Robert Durst might be the unluckiest person in the world. Like, think about this, guys. What if Robert Durst is truly innocent of all of these crimes, and he just seriously is the most unlucky person in the entire world that is just thrust into this, and it's just all completely backfired on him, and he's just the biggest schmuck on earth, and everyone hates him. I mean, that's a possibility, but, you know, not likely at this point, but it's just crazy to think. We'll move on quickly to the last episode, What the Hell Did I Do? And things sort of start to come together towards the end of episode 5 when some Susan Berman documents are revealed.
Gosh.
And I just can't believe that these documents weren't revealed earlier. I just don't buy that the police haven't had these for a while, and that Jarecki is the first person to ever get a hold of this envelope that says Beverly Hills on it. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
Like, how bad is our... are our investigators, you know,
well,
honestly,
you know, you have to cut them some slack on. And like I said, I was very, I think the New York detectives did a very poor job. But I'll come to the defense of the LA people. The LA guys, there's a lot that goes into bagging and tagging everything that's in a house. And it's, if you don't know exactly what you're looking for, and maybe the person who's processing the documents and stuff like that doesn't know exactly what we're looking. You know, there's a lot of ways that an envelope could slip through the cracks when you are going through the possessions of somebody in a, you know, a 4-bedroom house or something like that. Like it's not great. And you're right, Kent, but I have a hard time vilifying the detectives on that, because it's, man, that's a lot to ask for, to take all of this stuff and catch this one little thing that's not really evidence so much as it's just, God, all these documents, like how much stuff are we going through? And that's tough.
Yeah, it is rough. And it's just funny that, you know, pretty much the show is over. They say that Robert Durst is gone. They couldn't get a hold of him. And they really needed this second interview because they found this other letter that basically was extremely damning evidence that he wrote the letter to the police in the Susan Berman case, and they took it to a handwriting expert, and the handwriting expert even confirmed these were written by one person and one person only, both of these things. For some odd reason, Durst contacts Jarecki and wants to do another interview, and just keeps, like I said, just keeps pulling himself into this situation. Like, he must be obsessed with talking about these murders and getting away with it, and he just leaves every interview he does and just fist pumps that he's still getting away with this. I just can't believe it, that he would put himself in this situation. But so they get a second interview, and one of the better scenes in the series is them debating on how they're going to ask Robert Durst about this envelope. So they get Robert Durst in the interview room, and I think, man, hats off to Jarecki here. He handles this the absolute perfect way and asks the questions in the absolute perfect order. The fact that he gets Robert Durst to identify the letterhead beforehand, therefore proving that the letterhead on the Susan Berman letter came from Robert Durst himself and not from some imposter, I thought was genius. They didn't talk about that beforehand. I don't know if he came up with that on the cuff, but...
Yeah, they let him hang himself perfectly.
Exactly, yeah. And it's almost as incriminating as the handwriting itself. Mm-hmm. And he asks him, well, what similarities do you see here? He goes, well, Beverly is spelled wrong on both letters. And he says, well, don't you think that's coincidence? He goes, well, block letters are block letters. Does Robert Durst not know that people have different handwriting? Like, as if it's like a typewriter writing out letters or something.
Well, he said that. I mean, he says it's like it's a typewriter. Like, in his mind, and I don't know if that's an age thing, but it's you write in block letters or you write in cursive. Like, there's no
right.
It's really odd. That was really odd.
And the whole crux of the entire series comes down to him looking at both of the letters and saying, I wrote this one, but I didn't write this one. Jarecki puts both of them away, pulls out the sheet of paper that has both Beverly Hills written on it and says, can you tell me which one of these you wrote? And he says, no.
Yeah.
And that's where he's basically like, crap.
He's screwed at that point. But it was fascinating to me, especially the second time around, because the first time I'm tense, I'm focused on the events, and then what comes after that we'll talk about in a second is such a shocker that you kind of forget some of the other stuff. But it starts with like the burping thing. I don't know about you guys, and I want to get into the psychology of all this in a second, but it felt to me at that moment like something was going to come out of him. Like,
yeah,
he turned into for a second there. It was like he turned into a different person, and it was fascinating to me, especially watching the second time, to see this like descent into madness that he is undergoing. And I don't know exactly how long the last episode was filmed after the previous ones, because I know there's a large break between them where he's ignoring them and trying not to get into contact with them and all that sort of stuff. I felt like you could see – there were two moments leading up to that last episode where I felt like you could see the total crazy start to come out. And it was in episode 3 when we find out that Susan Berman got murdered, and Jarecki says something to him, like trying to prod him into like, hey, dude, like there's a big event that happens here. And he says, oh, yeah, Susan got murdered. Just so matter of factly that it was shocking to me. And in I think in the fourth episode, when they're going through the trial and he talks about dismembering this guy's body, and he goes on this long rant about all the tools that Morris had. And it's just, you know, he had this and this and this. And he says, but I don't think he had a bow saw. And then there's this long pause. And then he's just like, anyway, I went and bought a bow saw to cut this guy's body parts off. And it was that was disturbing to me. But I felt like those were the two moments where you really saw some of this deep-seated crazy starting to boil to the top. And in that last interview, it seems like all he can do to hold it together.
No, absolutely. It's crazy to think that people didn't incriminate him earlier. And I mean, I speak for myself here, but saying that I am not convinced at all. I mean, this guy is so creepy to me. There's not an ounce of like speaking from the heart that I feel about this guy. You know, from literally the first moment I laid eyes on him in the first episode, I was like, this guy is super psycho. Like, there's a scene or a shot where he's being arrested and he's walking in like prison garb and he just stares like directly into the camera and just the most piercing like stare you've ever seen. And it's like he's staring into your soul and just like, I mean, this guy just came off extremely creepy to me, and he has one of the worst poker tells of all time. Like, every time he lies about something, he just flinches his eyes. And, I mean, you got to have one of the worst, I guess, psychoanalysis investigators of all time to not, I guess, take that into account or look into that more. I mean, I felt like he was Gollum the entire time. He's just talking to himself and
100%
couldn't control what he was even saying at some point.
I 100% agree. And that's, to me, I almost hate to say this because he's always had such great defense attorneys. I don't know how any good defense attorney doesn't see this video, listen to the audio that we're going to talk about in a second, and say he's schizophrenic and get him into a mental institute for the rest of his life. Because if there is a to me, and I don't know what – I know a little bit about psychology. I'm certainly not a, you know, a licensed psychologist or something like that. To me, this is a textbook example of schizophrenia. And I thought that last episode, you see it more and more and more, because he's literally, he's talking to himself. And you're right, Kent, like it reminded me, it really reminded me of Gollum and the back and forth with himself.
Dual
and
personalities.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how a good defense attorney doesn't immediately go that route.
Yeah. So, we're wrapping this whole thing up. Robert Durst was arrested actually the day of the finale for the arrest of Susan Berman. And this is before, of course, all this evidence was given to the American public, at least from the TV standpoint. I just think that the LAPD has to know more than we know about this, had to have been looking into it more throughout this entire time, because there's no way, honestly, that they can convict him from what has been shown on. I mean, it'd be pretty easy to, but I don't think the legal system allows for them to watch a TV show and then arrest somebody. You know, there has to be some more evidence out there somewhere that we haven't seen. But I mean, this is going to be a story that's going to be pretty big over the next couple months, years, as this case unfolds. And it's going to be interesting to see also if they do a follow-up part two of this and try to give us more to the story. But so, you know, if you've seen the series, you'll probably keep up with it, but it's been incredible to watch and witness and all that. And, you know, it deserved this conversation, and, you know, it draws a lot of questions, like I said, about the judicial system. But, you know, I will always say, man, there's nothing like a good documentary, and this just proves it. It's just, there's really nothing like the truth. And
absolutely.
This was a fantastic watch on all levels. So I'm going to grade this.
And the final reveal was so good. Like it was so great. And the way that they shot it was perfect. I don't know how, and look, we obviously don't have the full audio, so there could definitely be editing tricks. And I'm guessing that will be the first course of action for his defense attorneys. But assuming that that we'll get uncut audio and he actually says the things he says, which the two things that got me were, he says, you know, one of the first things he says is he's talking to himself in the bathroom as well. There it is. You're caught. Yeah. Like that's damning. I don't know how you get out of that. Yeah. And then, you know, the closing line of, you know, where he's asking what the hell did I do? And then answers himself in kind of a creepy voice, like killed a little creepier all. Than his. Yeah. Killed them all. Of course. Like that's, I don't know how you get out of that. Like, I think your luck has run out at this point, dude.
He goes, yeah. He goes, well, there it is. You're caught. Oh, yes. My gosh. What a disaster. Oh, the burping. He just knew he was screwed, and crazy to see it all unfold. Yeah. But
I'm fascinated to see what happens with the trial and all that. Because I, like I said, I don't know how his defense doesn't go in and say, look, he's clearly crazy. He's clearly schizophrenic. Put him in a mental institute and he'll tell you where Kathy Durst's body is. You know, I don't know how they don't go that route almost immediately. I mean, I'm sure there's processes and that's a last case scenario, because you want to try and get him off, obviously, if you're the defense. But I don't see how that can happen, and I don't know how they could not watch that and listen to that and say, dude, I mean, this is as crazy as it gets.
We should move on to grades. I'm going to give this an A+. Freaking love this, and I hope there's more. You know, but if this sparks like more of these series for other murders on other networks, completely fine with rip-off Jinx series. And it probably won't be as good. But, you know, I'm super interested in this, and I'd love to see more. So A+ for me. Richard, great.
I'm just going to go solid A.
Boom. Brian.
A+ for me, and I'm with you, Kent. This is something that I think Serial was a kind of a phenomenon where it's like this shows what podcasts can be, and it kind of put podcasts on the map, really,
right,
for a lot of people. I know, like, we've seen a huge spike in our numbers since Serial became such a thing, and I'm assuming that most other podcasts are similar. This is kind of the same thing. Like, we've seen plenty of times how documentaries can be used to bring about justice or change or whatever. So there's lots of examples of that, but this is one of those, it's so relevant and it's so upfront right now and it's so in your face that I think it's such a good example of how important documentary filmmaking can be.
Exactly. And on that note, I'm going to give my recommend right now and move on to that and say, great documentary on Netflix, just was added this week. It was part of my my top 10 of the year. I mentioned it, but it's finally available for the mass audience to view. Life Itself, the Roger Ebert documentary, is on Netflix finally. Greatness. Roger Ebert, best movie critic of all time. Yep. And no debate about that, really. Check it out. Fantastic documentary. It deserves a conversation at a later date, but that's my recommend for this week. So watch it. Send your thoughts in to the show on it and let us know how you liked it. But you guys need to see it, Richard Bryan.
Yeah.
And I know you all will love it. So can't wait to talk about it with you sometime. So that's my recommend. Brian, what's your recommend?
I'm going to recommend an album. I've been listening a lot to – this is a strange album for me to recommend. I'll be honest with you. And I don't know if either of you guys will be on board for this. Yes, Cisco's. it's just the Thong Song on repeat. It's really cool.
No, it's the album after the Thong Song.
Okay, my bad.
It's a little without that one on there.
Yeah, that exists.
The all B-sides one.
All the deep cuts. The artist name is Sturgill Simpson, and I'm kind of late to the party. Oh, yeah. I know he's been fairly popular of late. His the album is called Metamodern Sounds and Country Music, and it is classic country to the nth degree, like the type of country that does not exist anymore, and also the type of country that I would listen to if it did exist. So I've been playing. I bought the vinyl and have been listening to that a couple times, and then I've had it playing in my car and at work, and it's kind of been on constant repeat. It is so good, and it's just such a throwback to, you know, whatever, Johnny Cash and Waylon and all that sort of stuff. The type of country music that I have a real affinity for that has just kind of been buried by bro country and all the junk. Thank God, like that. Yes.
I've never heard that title's a spinoff. You ever heard the Ray Charles record, the Modern Sounds and Country and Western Music?
Yes, fantastic album. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, okay, yeah,
I cool. think I have sure, because
that's
vinyl,
a great album.
Yeah,
it's one of my favorite albums of all time. So make sure.
Totally. So this is really good. It is like I recommended Jason Isbell probably a year ago, and that really might be my favorite record of all time. I'm like really getting to that point where I listen to it constantly and I love it. And I think that's something that it would appeal to almost anybody, cause it's more, a little more folksy than it is country, I guess. He doesn't have like a massive twang and the deep voice and all that sort of stuff. This is really deep country music. And so if you can't listen to Johnny Cash or Willie or Waylon or any of that stuff, then it's probably not going to be for you. But if you've ever enjoyed that kind of music, man, it's so good. And it's his lyrics are really great. And you may like it. You might give it a try. It's much different. I was kind of skeptical about it, and it quickly proved to be.
Does he sing about his truck or like his favorite light beer or his girl?
No, none of that. And it's
not interesting.
There's a lot of stoner references. So just
you mean
keep that in mind.
I think you mean American Treasure, Willie Nelson.
Yes, I forgot. Brian, I'm sorry.
I think you mean American Treasures, Florida Georgia Line.
Yeah, and Luke Bryan.
Pivens, Florida Georgia Line, and Luke Bryan. Richard, what's your recommend?
Yeah, you know what? I was just going to recommend that everyone come see us on Saturday, but I'll do a record too that I've been listening to a lot. I listened to it when it first came out last year, and then you guys were talking about it via text, so I started listening to it again, and even had it on in my car with Kent the other day. But we'll just do, hey, download or go seek out the New Basement Tapes.
Yes.
Great super group doing Bob Dylan songs. What else do you need?
Fantastic.
Yeah,
so good.
Yeah. Yeah, I picked it up last week, the physical copy, and it's been spinning constantly. Love it. And a modern classic. So that's absolutely a recommend. So good recommends. Great music, guys. Mm-hmm. Good documentary. Good documentary we talked about. And, of course, we'll see our listeners at the Alamo Draft House, hopefully. Come say hi. If not, we'll just be alone and we'll do a great podcast, I'm sure. But Brian, where can I find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at bgill12. You can find my writing at cambabiesdrinkredbull.com. Richard, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Richard Barden, or you can find my writing at richardbarden.com. Kent, where can I find you?
Find me on Twitter at Kent Garrison, and find all of our episodes on our website at madaboutmoviespodcast.com. If you like what you hear, leave us five stars on iTunes. And if you want to keep the show going, you can do so always by donating at our website. And on that note, we'll see you next time at the cinema.
Bye.
Bye. Hey, baby, I hear the blues are calling. Tossed salads and scrambled eggs. And maybe I seem a bit confused. Yeah, maybe, but I got you pegged. But I don't know what to do with those tossed salads and scrambled eggs. They're calling again. Scrambled eggs all over my face.
They're making me ya-ya. Salads and scrambled eggs.
They're calling again.